Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside. Special episode number 15, Samhain 2009. Hello! A very warm welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Gary.
And I'm Ruth. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen to our show. Well, it's now Samhain, or Halloween, as it's more commonly known. The time when the veil between the worlds grows thinner and the ghoulies and ghosties go bump in the night. Or something like that, isn't it?
You see, going bump in the middle of the night in our house is more than likely to be the cats knocking things off the windowsill.
That's very true. Anyway, if you fancy chatting to us, you can send an email to Gary and Ruth at CelticMythPodShow.com or talk to us in our forums or on our Facebook fan page or send a friendly house elf over to give us the message.
What makes you think we've been watching too much Harry Potter?
Yes, well, if you don't get on with it, there'll be no Quidditch for you later. Oh,
meanie. Okay, then. In this amazing show, you'll hear six great pieces of music, no information about the Festival of Samhain or Halloween, a section from Christine and Ethan Rose's great Celtic novel for young adults, Rowan of the Wood, a section from a brilliant book about the Cailleach, and an introduction to a fascinating new DVD called Standing with Stones.
Oh, hang on a minute. Hold on. What do you mean, no information about the festival?
Well, maybe a little. But we're going to be concentrating on the Cailleach, and to the ancient Celts, Samhain was a very special time for her.
So who is the Cailleach? I thought it was Cailleach, anyway.
No. I looked it up. The word is Scots Gaelic and means old woman, the veiled one, or the last handful of standing corn in a farm.
Good grief, that's packed with meaning then. Okay, shall we move on and have some news and views?
Yes, we'll do that.
The sad news is that Gary's health is still not improving, so things are going to be going quite slowly with the show for a while.
Yes, but the good news is the doctors now think they know what's going on, and after an operation I should be okay and we can get back up to speed again. I'd also like to say a really big thank you to all of you who have sent me your good wishes. I wish I could hug you all. Thank you so much.
Yes, but slowing you down has enabled you to start doing something else, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I've started to make some pictures, some wallpaper for your computers. And the first one is on the website already. It's a scene from the Battle of Moytura, and I've tried to make it an exciting picture. Not necessarily historically accurate.
You'll have to be a bit more accurate as we come forward in time, though, won't you?
Well, yes, yeah, I will. But that should be fun. I don't think there's anything else, so would you like to introduce the first piece of music?
Yes, I would. I made an astounding discovery just recently.
Oh, yes, you did.
And I found Green Lady Music. Green Lady Music is a husband and wife team, Doug and Jenna Green. She makes the music and he puts it all together. Mm. Their music has got strong Celtic roots combined with pagan and mythological streams, which comes out in their performance as almost an act of magic.
Really?
It's amazing. I think we'll be hearing much more from these two as time goes on. Anyway, see what you think of this track, which is called The Bard Song.
We honour now the Celtic bard, we offer up our praise. Guardians of our mysteries, keepers of the old ways. And Mother Earth of healing, seeing and giving. of ties to the seasons, the sun's rebirth, and all nature's lessons for living. We honor now the Celtic bard, we offer up our praise. Guardians of our mysteries, keepers of the old ways. We honor the bards of Celtic hope, the passing down tradition. Hundreds of songs from
the Bard Song by Jenna Green, and you can find it on her debut album, Crossroads.
Now that's fitting.
What do you mean?
Well, the Crossroads is a place sacred to the goddess Hecate, who's the Greek equivalent of our Kailach.
Ah, yes, I see.
So would you like to hear that section from the book about the Kailach now?
Yes, I would. This comes from a wonderful book by Sarita Deste and David Rankin called The Visions of the Kailach, and is subtitled Exploring the Myths, Folklore and Legends of the Preeminent Celtic Hag Goddess.
Exciting stuff!
Well, this book was sent to us for review by Sarita and David, and it's a real magical find. So much information about the Kailach gathered together in one place. I mean, it's not like it's easy to find much about her to begin with.
Although I notice we have started to hear about her as Bera, the Kailach Verla, in Andy Guthrie's tales. She makes the mountains by dropping rocks from her apron and carries an enormous hammer.
Yes, that's right. The Kailach is just as well known for her ability to summon or control water, often in the form of bad weather. In this book, they manage to find traces of her in Scotland, Ireland, Wales and England, the Isle of Man, Jersey, Brittany and even Norway.
Ah, that must be one of those many suspected links between the Norse and the Celtic worlds then.
Mm-hmm.
The giants and giantesses of Viking mythology may have been related to or descended from our earlier Celtic giantesses?
Well, it's possible. Going to the book, it says, several Scottish stories also connected floods with the Kailach, such as the formation of Loch Oar and Loch Ness. In the case of the formation of Loch Oar, some versions of the story imply that if the Kailach neglected to cap the well at night, the waters would eventually flood the entire world. This recalls the motif of the Great Flood, which some scholars have associated with her. However, the connections made in legends between the Kailach and the Great Flood is more usually based on her great age as a survivor of the flood.
In much the same way that we see Fintan and Tuan Macaril survive the flood?
Maybe. But there are other links between the gods showing her great age as well. Listen to this. The Kailach Ver was particularly associated with the Corrivecan whirlpool, north of the island of Jura, on the west coast of Scotland. The name Corrivecan means the cauldron of plat, taken from the legendary use of the whirlpool to wash her plat in. It was said that when she washed her plat and it was all white, winter was heralded, as implied by the symbolism of the white snow covering the land. The Corrivecan whirlpool is one of the largest in the world, greatly feared due to its unpredictability and the speed in which the weather can change in the surrounding area.
So, she's linked to the other ancient gods with cauldrons, like the Dugda in Irish mythology and Ceridwen in Welsh?
Yes, that's right.
And that's why she's so important at this time of year, isn't it? From Beltane to Samhain, the summer goddess Breed is said to spread her warmth throughout the world. But at Samhain, the Cailleach, the hug, the winter crone, takes over. The harshness of winter explains why she is to be feared. She's often seen as grumpy and dangerous.
Yes, and the book tells us a great story about that. Have a listen to this.
The Cailleach and Breed. All around Scotland, the tale was told in many variant forms of how the Cailleach bearer captured the summer maiden Breed and held her prisoner in her mountain hall beneath Ben Nevis, tallest mountain in Scotland. The different elements of this tale were brought together and told by Donald Mackenzie in his book Wonder Tales from Scottish Myth and Legend in 1917. The Cailleach's appearance was said to reflect the bleakness of winter. Her skin was blue-black, like a winter storm cloud. Her white hair looked like twigs covered in frost, and her single eye glared out at the world like the winter sun. The Cailleach was a harsh mistress and kept the beautiful Princess Breed captive.
Brit was given the hardest and most menial tasks to perform. One day, Bera gave Brit a brown fleece to wash, insisting she washed it in the nearby stream until it went completely white. One day, as she washed the fleece in a pool, she was approached by an old man who took pity on her. He shook the mantle three times, and the mantle turned as white as snow. He told her he was Father Winter and gave her some snowdrops. Father Winter said,
"If Bera scolds you, give her these flowers. And if she asks you where you found them, tell her that they came from the green rustling fir woods. Tell her also that the cress is springing up on the banks of streams and that the new grass has begun to shoot up in the fields."
Breed returned to the cave and was scolded by Bera when she saw the snowdrops. Breed repeated what she had been told, causing Bera to fly into a fury. Bera summoned 8 hag servants and spoke to them, saying,
"Ride to the north and ride to the south. Ride to the east and ride to the west. And I will ride forth also. Smite the world with frost and tempest, so that no flower may bloom and no grass blade survive. I am waging war against all growth."
When she had spoke thus, the 8 hags mounted on the backs of shaggy goats and rode forth to do her bidding. Bera went forth also, grasping in her right hand her magic hammer. On the night of that very day, a great tempest lashed the ocean to fury and brought terror to every corner of the land.
The reason that Bera kept Breed captive was her son Angus the Ever Young, who had fallen in love with Breed after seeing her in a dream. Angus was the antithesis of his mother, warm and gentle, where she was cold and harsh. During the winter months, he lived apart from her on the Green Isle to the west, also known as the Isle of Youth.
Here we can see the Irish influence on this story. Angus Ever Young was clearly derived from Angus MacOg, whose name meant Angus Young Son. Breed is a maiden goddess of the Irish pantheon of the Tuatha De Danann. The Green Isle of the West was obviously a reference to Ireland, which is to the west of Scotland, and was known as the Emerald Isle. Ireland was also the location of Tiernanog, which means land of youth. Angus asks the king of the Green Isle about the maiden in his dreams, and the king of the Green Isle answered, saying, "The fair princess whom you saw is Breed, and in the days when you will be king of summer, she will be your queen. Of this, your mother, Queen Bera, has full knowledge, and it is her wish to keep you away from Breed, so that her own reign may be prolonged. Tarry here, O Angus, until the flowers begin to bloom and the grass begins to grow, and then you shall set free the beautiful Princess Breed.
Angus did not want to wait, and decided to rescue Breed, ignoring the advice of the King of the Green Isle, who pointed out that it was the month of the wolf, February, and the temper of the wolf weather was always uncertain. So Angus borrowed 3 days from August and cast a spell on the land and on the sea, causing the sun to shine and the weather to be fine. Although he searched across the land on his white horse, Angus could not find Brid. Brid saw Angus in her dreams and wept tears of joy, which formed violets when they touched the ground. Determined to thwart him, Bera raised a gale on the third day, which blew Angus back to the Green Isle. Angus returned again and again, until he found her in a forest near Ben Nevis. Angus approached her, saying,
"Beautiful princess, I beheld you in a dream weeping tears of sorrow."
"Mighty prince, I beheld you in a dream, riding over the bends through the glens in beauty and power.
I've come to rescue you from Queen Bera, who's kept you long in captivity."
"To me this is a day of great joy."
"Oh, it'll be a day of great joy to all mankind, ever after this."
That is why the first day of spring, the day on which Angus found the princess, is called Brid's Day. Angus and Brid were found by a company of fairy ladies, who took them to the fair court, where they were married with great ceremony. Angus cast magic spells to spread growth across the land. Bera felt Angus's magic and furiously, repeatedly struck the ground with her magic wand until it was frozen again. She sent her hag servants out to scour the lands for Angus and Brid, who were driven to the safety of the Emerald Isle. Angus longed to return to Scotland and many times crossed the sea, bringing the sunshine with him.
Bera raised storm after storm to drive him away. First, she called on the wind named the Whistle, which blew high and shrill and brought down rapid showers of cold hailstones. It lasted for 3 days, and there was much sorrow and bitterness throughout the length and breadth of Scotland. Sheep and lambs were killed on the moors, and horses and cows perished also.
Angus fled, but he returned soon again. The next wind that Bera raised to prolong her winter reign was the sharp-billed wind, which is called Gobag. It lasted for 9 days, and all of the land was pierced by it, for it pecked and bit every nook and cranny like a sharp-billed bird.
Angus returned, and the Bera raised the eddy wind, which is called the Sweeper. Its whirling gusts tore branches from the budding trees and bright flowers from their stalks. All the time it blew, Bera kept beating the ground with her magic hammer so as to keep the grass from growing. But her efforts were in vain. Spring smiled in beauty all around, and each time she turned away, wearied by her efforts, the sun sprang forth in splendour. Small, modest primroses opened their petals in the sunshine, looking forth from cosy nooks that the wind called the Sweeper was unable to reach. Angus fled, but he soon returned again.
Bera was not yet, however, entirely without hope. Her efforts had brought disaster to mankind, and the weeks of leanness came on. Food became scarce. The fishermen were unable to venture to the sea on account of Bera's tempests and could get no fish. In the night time, Bera and her hags entered the dwellings of mankind and stole away their stores of food. It was indeed a sorrowful time.
Angus was moved with pity for mankind and tried to fight the hags of Beara, but the fierce queen raised the gales of complaint to keep him away, and they raged in fury until the first week of March. Horses and cattle died for want of food, because the fierce winds blew down stacks of fodder and scattered them over the lochs and the ocean. Angus, however, waged a fierce struggle against the hag servants, and at length he drove them away to the north, where they fumed and fretted furiously.
Beara made a final attempt to defeat Angus and maintain Winter's dominance. She gathered her hags and smote the clouds with her magic staff, creating the Black Tempest. Winter continued, and Beara borrowed 3 days from Winter to balance the 3 days that Angus had previously borrowed. Those 3 days were Tempest spirits riding black hogs, which Beara set free to wreak devastation. For 3 days, known as Hog's Days, they froze the land, killing many animals and people with their unexpected bleak cold.
Beara's reign was now drawing to a close. She found herself unable to combat any longer against the power of the new life that was rising in every vein of the land. The weakness of extreme old age crept upon her. She longed once again to drink of the waters of the Well of Youth. When, on a bright March morning, she beheld Angus riding over the hills on his white steed, scattering her fierce hag servants before him, she fled away in despair. Ere she went, she threw her magic hammer beneath a holly tree, and that's the reason that no grass grows under holly trees.
Beara's black steed went northward with her in flight. As it leapt over Loch Etive, it left the marks of its hoofs on the side of a rocky mountain, and that spot is named to this day, Horseshoes. She did not rein up her steed until she reached the Isle of Skye, where she found rest on the summit of the old wife's ben, Benny Kylich, at Broadford. There she sat, gazing steadfastly across the sea, waiting until the day and the night would be of equal length. All that equal day she wept tears of sorrow for her lost power. And when night came, she went westward over the sea to Green Island. At the dawn of the day that followed, she drank the magic waters of the Well of Youth.
This epic battle between the Kylich as winter and Angus and Breed as summer, with its different winds and shifting weather patterns, explained the erratic weather patterns of spring. The end of the tale, where the Kylich restored herself with the waters of youth, recalls her power over water, and also implies the transformation from crone to maiden, found in several of the other Kylich stories. And that finishes the story of the Kylich and Breed. I thought it was important to read it out fully, as the relationship between the Kylich at winter and Breed at summer is really highlighted by this tale.
It is. It's fascinating how she was served by her hags in this tale, isn't it?
Yes, and there's obviously more than one Kylich as well.
One of the themes in this book is to document as many stories of the Kylich as they could find, and in the process they think they've discovered some evidence of a hidden cult of priestesses serving the Kylich. And maybe that last story is one of the clues.
Interesting. They've done such a good job with this book.
They have indeed. Look, let's take a break for a piece of music, because there's one more short tale I'd like us to read from the book before we leave it.
Okay. What did you have in mind?
Well, do you remember that we were sent a poem some time ago called The Pattern for the listener-inspired section on the website?
Oh, yes, yes. It was written by a lady in a band, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was written by Kim McKee after her first trip to Ireland, and she and Kenny Wilson have put it to music. Kim heard the myths and legends of the women folk knitting a special pattern into their husbands' and sons' sweaters to recognise them. So if they were lost at sea and found later on, They could be identified.
Good grief. That's amazing.
Hmm.
I wonder how much of that tradition is a direct descendant from different Celtic knots identifying different clans and families.
I don't know, but it's interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Let's have a listen to Wilson and McKee's The Pattern.
The Pattern by Wilson and McKee and comes from their 1995 album of the same name.
Really beautiful, isn't it?
It's lovely.
You can find out more about Kim and Kenny at their website at www.jigheads.com or in our show notes.
Now, you mentioned there was just one more small section from Visions of the Cailleach that you wanted to read to us.
Oh, yes. This is a short piece from a period of Irish mythology that we haven't got to yet, but it concerns Niall of the Nine Hostages meeting a crone who grants him sovereignty.
Oh, right.
Well, there are archetypes in this story that occur throughout Celtic mythology, and it's well worth looking at.
Oh, it does sound exciting. Off you go, then. I'm ears akimbo.
Nile of the Nine Hostages. The Irish 11th century tale of Nile and the Nine Hostages places the sovereign bestowing crone at the centre of the story. Nile and his four older brothers become lost in a wood and were all desperately thirsty. They came upon a crone, possibly the Cailleach, guarding a well, and asked her for a drink of water from the well. The crone responded by demanding a kiss from anyone who wished to drink from the well. Well, Nile's four brothers refused the hag's offer. We can see here the magical connotations of water and the well as symbolising the magic of the other world and the entrance to the transformatory womb of the earth. Nile, however, did not reject the crone, but rather accepted the
hideous shape, thin-shanked, grey-headed, bushy-browed
figure. He even went so far as to
around her he closed his arms. He strained her to his breast and bosom as though she were forever his own spouse.
During the embrace, the crone transformed herself into the most beautiful maiden imaginable, described in the story as
the fairest in human form.
Nile asked the woman her name and was told, I am sovereignty. She then went on to make a prophecy and compared his reign allegorically to their embrace, with a rough beginning, smooth middle, and peaceful end.
Oh, that's amazing. And you're right. How many times do we come across a story with similar themes to this one? First impressions are often wrong. The mature woman is often more beautiful, as it were, than the young maiden. And she has the gifts of wisdom and prophecy and so on.
Exactly. It's worth noting that she's guarding a well in this story. Mm. Maybe the well of youth. Or perhaps another cauldron of plenty.
Yes, there are lots of possibilities. Anyway, I think you'll agree that we both recommend this book. Well done, David and Sarita. A superbly researched, written and stimulating book.
Absolutely. And you can find more details in the show notes. Now, the music you heard during the reading was Scott Boswell's Samhain Dance and Winter by Frozen Silence. Check these guys out in the show notes to find out more about their wonderful music.
Talking of music, let's move on and hear about the Banshee's Wail at this Samhain time from the Blarney Rebel Band. The band come from central New York, and they aim to get their audience dancing, clapping, singing, maybe even raising a pint. Now that sounds a good idea. So, let's listen to the story of the Banshee from the Blarney Rebel Band.
Come gather round and listen to my tale. Take warning when you hear the banshee's wail. 'Cause if the banshee calls your name, they say your soul is hers to claim. Her cry can make the strongest man turn pale. And who tonight, will it be tonight? Who will it be tonight? Will it be tonight? One autumn night, as the sky was bleak and gray, my mother's mother came to our house to stay. as we sat down to our evening meal. The cry came from across the fields. She never woke to see the light of day. And who will it be tonight? Will it be tonight? Who will it be tonight? Will it be tonight? Dressed all in white with hair of shining gold. Her bikini makes a brave man's heart run cold. She'll call you when your time is done, and comfort she can give you none. Once your fate the banshee has foretold. Tonight again we hear the banshee cry. We sadly look into each other's eyes. We know tomorrow when we meet, the table holds an empty seat. One of us won't see another sunrise. And who will it be tonight? Will it be tonight? Who will it be tonight? Will it be tonight? Who will it be tonight? Will it be tonight? Who will it be tonight? Will it be tonight?
That's just so good, isn't it?
Mm.
The track is called Banshee from their album By My Soul, and you can find out where to go and get it in our show notes. So, do you think it's time for a story?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, what have we got for this holiday special?
Ah. Well, we're lucky enough to bring you the beginning of the amazing Celtic fantasy novel for young adults by Christine and Ethan Rose called Rowan of the Wood.
Yes, I've really been looking forward to this one. On the back cover of the book, it tells us a little about it. Apparently, it tells the story of Cullen, a 12-year-old outcast who travels through a redwood forest every day on his way to school. Losing himself in books and a fantasy world of elves, fairies and wizards, Cullen's life changes incredibly one day when he uncovers an ancient magic wand that is inhabited by a powerful wizard, Rowan. Inadvertently, the wizard possesses Cullen and emerges from him at times of crisis. Rowan and Cullen try to understand what's happened to them, only to discover they share a deeper problem.
Mm.
Now, I'm not going to read any more, as you are about to find out.
Ah. Rowan of the Wood, Chapter 1. Caledonia, circa 592 AD. The wind whipped over the rolling highlands, blowing the heather in a frenzied dance. The flowers filled the air with fragrant sweetness.
A herd of deer seemed to glide across the hills in the fading daylight, turning together as one to follow the wind. The autumn moon emerged red over the horizon, impossibly big and perfectly round. The harvest moon. Its light spilled over the mountains as it ascended into the ever-darkening sky, eventually finding the sacred stone circle below. A bonfire blazed within its center, casting a warmer, livelier light than the distant moon. Lavishly painted figures danced around the fire, wearing little more than the blue paint on their skin. They exhaled a visible mist, despite the bonfire, and goosebumps showed on their bodies. They held autumn wreaths and harvest fruits in their hands as they twirled and wove around and between each other. A handful of celebrants skillfully played shallow, flat drums, or kept the rhythm with rib bones played like castanets between the first three fingers. The beat echoed with the pulse of the life around them. They moved and leapt into the air with impressive grace, staying in perfect rhythm with the cadence. One woman, with wild blonde hair, played a flute while she danced, with pixie-like movements, light and graceful. She skipped around the fire, weaving amongst the dancers. Her fingers flew over the stops as nimbly as her feet frolicked over the frozen ground. A massive, flat stone, resting on two boulders, dominated one end of the circle, serving as an altar. Several carved gourds sat upon it. Their candle-lit faces flickered to the sounds of the surrounding drumbeats. An old man and woman with long white hair happily tapped their toes to the merriment. Every breath showed the quickly dropping temperature, and still they danced until the drumming and the dancing ended simultaneously on a heavy downbeat. Synchronized, as if the drums still played, the tribe turned their attention to a man and woman who had appeared in the firelight at the far end of the stone circle, opposite the altar. They stood there, regally, dressed in deep green ceremonial robes, decorated with the intricate knotwork of their tribe. The uncertain light hit their age well, but their pale faces revealed four decades of joy and love imprinted in their crow's feet and smile lines. The woman's red flowing hair twisted in the wind. She wore a wreath of heather and rosemary on her head. Her green eyes gazed upon her companion adoringly. A red beard lightly covered his chiseled jaw, and a wreath of rosemary decorated his own red locks. His eyes, full of love and kindness, looked into hers. Something deeper also burned in his blue eyes. Unquenched desire and a love like fire. He took her hand and pulled her close, his crown of herbs touching hers. The wind entwined the strands of their hair together. A nocta nera. He whispered in the Gaelic native to them all and placed a soft kiss on her forehead. Tonight, finally. Rowan and Fianna had finally reached their wedding day. They had each heard the call of the goddess for service, and they had each answered. From the young age of 10, they began the long journey towards becoming a druidic priest and priestess. They'd been childhood friends before that, and fell in love by the age of 12. Tradition demanded they remain chaste, which proved difficult during the years of such close proximity. While their outside friends grew up, got married, and had children, they remained pure to honor their tribe and their customs. They had vowed to wait until after they had been anointed as the tribe's new priest and priestess, gathering power and magic to help and protect their people. For 30 long years they had waited, but their wedding day had finally arrived. Tonight, they would be anointed and wed at long last. The crowd before them chanted. As if it pained them to be out of the other's reach. Their fingertips lingered a moment longer than necessary before parting completely. They each walked around the bonfire on opposite sides, between it and their surrounding tribe. The painted people gathered hand-woven baskets full of multicolored leaves and showered at the pair as they passed. Fianna felt more like a goddess than a priestess. She reveled in the warmth of her tribe's love and looked past the dancing flames to her betrothed. Many maidens would be frightened on their wedding night, but not her. She had waited too long. Fear was the furthest emotion from her mind. Nothing could go wrong tonight. Nothing! The moon, now high in the sky, created gentler shadows below. The fire illuminated the falling leaves, which shone like gold as they twirled down onto the preceding couple. Rowan caught sight of Fianna gazing at him through the fire, and his heart quickened once again. The autumn leaves fluttered around him in a burst of colour, and the chanting of his tribe filled his ears, but nothing could draw his attention away from Fianna. She was the most beautiful woman he had ever known. Oh, and tonight he would have her in his arms at last. Tonight would be the beginning of their life together as priest and priestess, as protectors of their tribe, as husband and wife, as lovers. As soon as he could see her clearly on the far side of the fire, he reached for her hand. She took it eagerly, meeting his unwavering gaze. They approached the altar, hand in hand. Clad in white robes, the old couple at the altar waited patiently for them. The man smoothed down his long white beard, causing the tip that extended past his belly to dangle and dance in the wind. The old woman's braid extended even longer, straight down her back, nearly reaching her knees. Rowan and Fianna had been chosen to replace them, the reigning priest and priestess of this tribe. It was a great honor to be chosen, not only for themselves, but for their families as well. No one had expected the fire of the goddess to burn so brightly inside them. Many of the tribe had commented on how powerful they were. Even the elders spoke of power that exceeded all the stories and tales. Together, they would be more puissant than anything the tribe had ever known. After their union, they alone would be powerful enough to chase the invaders, who had renewed vigor with their new ways, back out of Caledonia forever. They knew little about this new religion, but many of the men who followed it used it as an excuse to kill any who practiced the old ways and refused to convert. Their beliefs gave them a sense of superiority and the justification to rid the world of those they called heathens. The union of these two lovers on this magical night would not only alter their fate, but it would also change the destiny of the tribe and all of Caledonia. To further increase their power, they had chosen the night of Samhain to consummate their love. The veil to the other world was the thinnest on this night. The magic that would flow into them would create a bond that could never be broken, not even by death. They had so longed for this moment, and it would all happen tonight. The tribe moved closer to the altar to get a better look. Some shivered in the cold and huddled by the fire, but all were silent. Only the crackle of the fire and the faint whisper of the wind could be heard on this magical night. The heat rose between the couple's eyes, and the old priest finally broke the silence. He cleared his throat and then spoke loudly in the throaty beauty of Gaelic, welcoming their dear friends. Fulcher, Virena Fulcher Kirta. The crowd's attention focused on him. Even Rowan and Fianna broke their gaze to face him, their retiring priest, reverently.
Today we celebrate the union of spirit and flesh between Rowan and Fianna. Through decades of study, they have perfected the roles of bard and green maiden. They are now ready on this sweet, solemn night to be elevated to the rank of priest and priestess. They are our new way. A new generation of magic and power begins with this union. Through our spiritual dance, we welcome the dawn of winter and the slumber of autumn, on the nights where those who have passed into the other world might look upon us, sharing the magic of their world with us who remain in this one. May the goddess fill their bodies with her essence this night, and in their union bring together all of Caledonia in safety and love.
He turned momentarily away from them and lifted a thick chunk of bread from the stone altar. Tearing it in half, he said,
"As a symbol of the god's blessing, I offer this bread to you."
Rowan took the bread and fed it to Fianna, saying,
"May you never hunger."
He purposely let his finger glide across the bottom of Fianna's lip. She gasped slightly and smiled, feeling her face flush at his touch. The sensation quickly spread throughout her body. She saw the same desire burning in his eyes as he took a bite of the bread. The priest cleared his throat again, snapping their attention back to him. He turned to his wife, who now held a silver goblet, and she spoke with a voice deeper than one would expect to emerge from such a delicate, frail woman.
"As a symbol of the goddess's blessing, I offer this wine."
Fianna took the chalice and held it up to Rowan's lips, tilting the cup towards him.
"May you never thirst."
The wine felt warm on his lips against the chill of the night, but once inside, it called the heat, impatient to burst forth. Fianna too tasted the bitter wine. Then they both returned the offering to the old couple. The old priest motioned for them to join hands. They crossed their arms and took the other's hand into their own, forming the symbol for infinity. Fianna felt the penetration of Rowan's eyes into her very soul, and she had to catch her breath. The old priestess took one end of a braided tartan cloth. The old priest took the other end, Together, they bound the hands of the bride and groom.
You have both waited a long time. You have each passed the tests. And now it's time for celebration and union.
You are now bound together in love. Forever.
Rowan and Fianna clasped their hands tightly together, gazing at each other in anticipation. The tribe collectively held their breath, waiting.
Don't just stand there.
The old man chided with a smile.
Kiss her.
Rowan laughed heartily, and the newly wedded couple fell into each other's arms, kissing passionately, as if they'd been waiting their entire lives for this moment. They had. Not once in all these years have they stolen even a single kiss. And now Fianna's lips felt even softer than petals of heather against his own. Desire welled up inside him, and he felt like he would burst. Being this close to her, he found his own flesh an obstacle. He wanted nothing more than to fold himself inside her skin and become one person. Nothing else would be close enough. With their tribe roaring in approval behind them, the drumming and the dancing struck up as their lips parted from their first kiss. But their arms remained tightly wrapped around each other. The smiles on their faces shone as tears of joy sparkled in their eyes. They held each other tightly and swayed to the music. A horrible thunk suddenly interrupted the celebration, not at all in rhythm with the drumbeat. The music, staggering into silence, drew Rowan's attention away from his new wife. He turned to the priest and saw the old man's smile fade as a bright red stain spread across his white robe like a blooming rose. He stumbled backwards against the stone altar, knocking over a goblet, propping himself up against the rough stone. He grasped the arrow sticking awkwardly out of his chest, not understanding what had just happened. The old woman rushed to her dying husband, whispering incantations over his wound. A painted woman behind them screamed. Clasping Fianna tightly to his chest, Rowan whipped around to see scores of angry men pouring into their sacred ceremony. No, not tonight. Fianna felt her heart sink in her chest, hollow with the loss of hope. She looked up at Rowan in what seemed like slow motion. The sadness in his eyes matched her emptiness. A tear fell from the corner of her eye. The wind touched the wetness and she felt cold. Rowan wiped it away with his thumb, ending their timeless moment together. They stepped away from each other, ready for battle. The crowd fled from their attackers in all directions, but few got away before the bloodshed began. A man on horseback seized the flautist, flinging her across the horse's neck as he rode away with her screaming. Other men had long swords and rushed the frightened community. They'd been wearing so little for the ceremony, most of the tribe were completely unarmed. Oh, it would have been careless of them, but they'd never expected this. Not tonight. One man stepped in front of a near-naked woman, trying to protect her. But one of the attackers cornered them and viciously drove his sword through them both. Rowan's once gentle face filled with anger as he watched his tribe being torn apart. He felt his desire for Fianna replaced by the heat of rage. As he reached down the bell sleeve of his robe and pulled out a knotty piece of wood just as one of the invaders descended upon him, Rowan threw him off with the strength of many men. The man's clutching hand ripped the front of Rowan's robe, revealing a Celtic tree tattooed on his chest. He pointed the wand at the invaders and screamed, "Stadoim!" Fianna appeared right beside him, wand drawn, and repeated,
"Stadoim!"
Instinct had taken over, and the tears had dried. Her anger made her strong and focused. The magic of the goddess coursed through her. more powerful than ever before. A few men stopped, frozen by the magic, but most of the assailants continued the slaughter without even a glance at their statuesque companions.
There are too many,
Fianna cried, in the midst of throwing spells at their attackers. Her confidence wavered, Rowan's being filled with dread. His first day as priest, and he'd get them all killed. Oh, he should have been better prepared. He would fail them all unless he could find a way to help them. To save them. To save her. He looked around for some sign of an exit, but they were surrounded. Then he noticed a thin blue haze appearing over the altar. The smoke began to part out in the middle, and it spread into a doorway. Their salvation. The other world! He screamed to Fianna, pointing to the open doorway. Get as many as you can through the veil. We'll be safe there until it reopens.
And you?
I'll be close behind.
I will not leave you. Not now.
I'll be right behind. Now go, before it's too late.
You cannot hold them alone.
She was right. And he knew it. He could not hold them alone. But together they could. Their greatest power took form when they touched. Rowan grabbed Fianna's hand, and a surge of energy shuddered through them from the heart of the earth. With a unified, deepened voice, they pointed their wands and shouted,
Stadime!
Their adversaries all froze where they stood. Confused and frightened looks plastered on their still animated faces. Their eyes rolled wildly like trapped beasts, trying to understand why they couldn't move. Rowan turned to Fianna. The magic they conjured shone from her like a divine light, making her even more beautiful than ever. He forced himself to look away from the goddess before him, and to his frightened people he shouted, All of you, through the veil! He knew the spell wouldn't last long once they broke the connection. The tribe looked at the doorway uncertainly, and then back to the remains of their fallen friends. As soon as the spell broke, the killing would resume.
It's the only way to survive.
Quickly, now!
He spoke the last words in thunderous reverberation. The frightened people rushed past the newlyweds, past the altar, and into the blue smoke. As they stepped through, they disappeared from mortal sight.
Now you, my love. Go. When we break our connection, I can only hold them for a moment. I'll be right behind you.
Fianna looked at him and pleaded with her eyes. Her heart filled with the love and longing that had consumed her adulthood, pushing the emptiness away. How could she leave him? Even for a moment. Stay and die together? Or go and risk never seeing him again? Oh, she searched for some other way, but found none.
Fianna, we do not have the time. We'll be together in the other world.
Wringing her hands in worry, Fianna said,
But no one has ever crossed over and come back alive.
And we will be the first. Once we complete our union, my love, our power will be greater than any has ever known. Now go!
The gentle urgency in his voice brimmed with regret and love as he spoke to her. He squeezed her hand and then let it go. She hesitated, perhaps a moment too long, a moment that would haunt her forever. Rowan struggled to hold the slowly reanimating attackers. His fallen brethren surrounded him. The doorway began to close. The blue smoke became denser. Fianna lingered on the threshold. She cried to her husband,
Rowan, the veil, it's closing.
Go through.
Not without you.
Go through now. I'm coming.
He ran toward her as the angry men came at him. Fianna passed through, and Rowan followed right behind her. But instead of passing into the other world with the others, he walked right through the smoke. Right through Fianna.
Fianna screamed in anguish and fell to her knees, reaching out towards him, her husband trapped on the other side of the veil with the invaders. Rowan could not hear her, but he could still faintly see her fallen figure through the fading smoke. He had no time to try and stop the angry men. Only a moment more and they would be upon him. "Come back for me," Rowan said to Fianna's pale figure, pointing his wand to the middle of the tattoo on his chest. He said, "Folly." In a flash of light, he disappeared into his wand, and it fell next to the altar. The men stopped abruptly when Rowan disappeared, looking around, confused. They backed away from the wand, lying motionless on the ground, crossing themselves, mumbling prayers of protection. A brazen fat monk, bolder than the rest, pushed through their ranks and strode up to the edge of the remaining smoke, smiling. Fianna watched in dismay through the disappearing veil as the monk stood over the fallen wand. He curiously picked the wand up and, with a look of triumph, slid it with some difficulty into the rope belt around his overstuffed belly. Fianna reached out in pain as the veil closed, knowing it would be a year before she could return. She watched, helplessly, as the monk walked away. How exciting was that?
Oh yes, what a brilliant start to the book. What else can you tell us about the book?
Well, you must have figured out by now that poor old Rowan was trapped inside that wand of his right up until modern times, until he meets Cullen. Unknown to Rowan, Fianna had used dark magic to stay alive over the centuries and has now descended deeper into darkness and become something evil.
Also, I can see some of the problems coming up. Also, did you know that Christine and Ethan Rose have a brand new book out called Witch on the Water that's a follow-up to Rowan of the Wood and continues the adventures of Cullen and Rowan?
I didn't hear a rumour.
Well, Christine and Ethan have kindly offered a superb book package as a competition prize. The book package contains a copy of their novels, Rowan of the Wood and the new one, Witch on the Water. Also, a beautiful handmade Green Man journal.
An amazing prize. Can I win it, please?
No.
Oh.
To enter the competition, all you have to do is answer the following question. What colour stockings did the Wicked Witch of the East wear in the 1939 movie The Wizard of Oz? Just drop us an email with Rowan Competition in the subject line and we'll put all the entries into a hat and they'll be drawn out in 2 weeks' time on the 15th of November. We'll announce the winner on the website blog, the forums and the fan page.
And now, after all that excitement, let's have some music.
Good idea. This next piece of music is by our friend Paul Newman, Mr. Sunshine Paul, and is a song called Shore of Dreams, which is a preview track from his next album, After Summer Armour.
Details in the show notes?
Details in the show notes.
The taste of salt. And oceans roar on a coast I'd never been before. Turaluraye. The stones are strange, the sand is brown. I close my eyes and lay me down. Turaluraye. I see a ring of dancers there with moonlit skin and waist-long hair. Turaluraye. I find a coat to keep me warm, that I may watch the dance till dawn. That coat is mine, she says to me, and is my passport to the sea. Though on the land I sometimes roam, the waves and water are my home. Say fate has brought us here tonight, I'll keep this coat and hold it tight. Turaluraye. live such a lonely life. If I keep this, you'll be my wife. Maybe so, she says to me, what will you give for my dowry? I swear to you by wave and foam to give you comfort, hearth and home. She breathes her name into my ear as daylight comes and sun appears. A name I will hear evermore when I hear waves upon the shore.
Paul, that was amazing. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Paul. So ethereal and otherworldly. Really beautiful.
I wonder how many of you spotted it was a song about something in Celtic mythology.
Ah, yes, it was the Selkie.
Ah.
And Paul has just released his first music video called Samhain Song. It's a great song with more than a hint of humour.
I always laugh. Yeah, pop along to sunshinepaul.blogspot.com. Be entertained.
Do you remember meeting Matthew Callow at the Fairy Festival in Kent earlier this year?
Yes, I do. Yeah, very bubbly chap, wasn't he?
That's
at the
Anne
de Gorshead conference.
Yes, that's Matthew.
Yes.
Well, he's actually the editor of a super new magazine called The Magical Times.
Ah.
Now, the magazine covers subjects such as paganism, nature fairies, meditation and folklore. And also features some absolutely beautiful fairy art. So I just thought I'd let our listeners know about it. Now, they have a website which has got loads of information on. Oh, and keep an eye out for their fabulous fairy calendar. It's for 2010 and I've already put our order in.
Have you?
I have. I can't wait to get it. Anyway, you can find out lots more about the Magical Times and the fairy calendar by visiting their website at themagicaltimesmagazine.co.uk. And you can find that address in the show notes as well. There's something else we were sent for review that we think you guys might like to know about.
Is that?
Yes, we've been watching an absolutely fascinating DVD called Standing with Stones.
Oh, yes, Standing Stones and stuff like that.
Yes, there's a little bit more to it than that. It's over 2 hours long and documents one man's journey around megalithic Britain to visit over 100 sites.
Yes, that's right. Rupert Soskin, who's a fascinating bloke, shows us some remarkable sites. I hadn't seen half of the places in this DVD, and now I want to visit them all.
All right then, let's hire out a caravan and go touring.
Oh, wouldn't that be lovely? Anyway, dreaming aside, Rupert and his director split the UK up into areas, and they visit many of the most famous sites.
And Rupert often has some fascinating theories of his own about some of these places.
He does, doesn't he? Well, let's have a listen to some clips, starting with Rupert's visit to Callanish in the Highlands.
I've been waiting to come here for years, and actually being here is more breathtaking than I ever imagined. No photograph can capture the sheer majesty of the place. It's a work of Neolithic wonder. Greater even than the astronomical brilliance of the recumbent stone circles, Callanish is the greatest prehistoric observatory of them all. Situated on the Hebridean island of Lewis, I think it's utterly implausible that it was built by the islanders themselves simply for local use. Indeed, one of the enduring legends of Callanish is that it was built by black men who came from over the sea. There is a burial cairn here, but it was added long after the stones were erected. And lacking the stone altar of the recumbents, the implication is that this was a place of science rather than religion. The full lunar cycle of 18.61 years is marked and predicted by these monoliths, but here the wider horizon is the stage. Just once in each cycle, the moon seems to come down from the sky to touch the earth, disappearing behind the hills, only to reappear in a final display, gleaming between the central stones as it passes.
You can imagine the beautiful photography that accompanies his visit, can't you?
Yes, we'll try and get a picture of Callanish up in the show notes. Any more?
Oh, yes. The next clip is about the Druids on Anglesey. I thought that was rather appropriate.
High in the hills overlooking Conway Bay sits a site called the Druid Circle. All through Wales, links with the Druids seems to grow stronger, and here, it's not without reason. Although little is known about them, we do know that in Celtic tradition, the Druids were already long established by 200 BC. To the rest of society, these revered teachers clearly held a special status, and from the later accounts of Julius Caesar, referring to the Druids in Gaul, we find that they were exempt from all normal taxes and obligations.
Interestingly, when it came to electing a successor for the position of Supreme Druid, if it couldn't be resolved by vote, it was decided by armed force. So much for peaceful mistletoe pickers. The Roman invasion of Britain was ruthless, and as they forged their way north, the opposing Brits, along with the Druids, were forced to retreat ahead of them through Wales. And it was AD 60 that everything came to a head. Rome had to overcome the troublesome Druids if it was going to achieve total control of Britain. It was here on the Isle of Anglesey that the Druids made their last stand against the might of the Roman Empire. And contemporary accounts tell of a people far removed from the peaceful white-robed mystics imagined by Stukeley.
The final battle started here at the Menai Strait. The Roman army arrived at the riverbank over there and looked across to a terrifying sight. Tacitus described the enemy as a dense array of armed warriors. He said, "Women in black with dishevelled hair were dashing between the ranks like furies and waving brands. Druids with their arms in the air yelling curses at the Roman army." He says that the soldiers were paralysed with fear. But nonetheless, the Romans won. And the Druids' mythical status today is the legacy of that once powerful force. And who knows what body of knowledge died with them.
And the last section is about an amazing discovery that Rupert made in the Bryn Celli Ddu in North Wales.
Okay, let's listen.
Gotta be honest with you, I came here yesterday and I thought that when I got to Anglesey, I'd tell you about the Druids and show you a couple of sites and go. But I found something here that I really can't understand how it's been missed before, and it's genuinely the most exciting thing I've ever discovered, and yesterday it left me stunned for hours. Come and have a look at this. This is the burial chamber, and here stands an impressive pillar of stone. It doesn't touch the ceiling, so it's not structural. It's important in its own right. Now, archaeological texts and writings about this site have described this as a monolith and as a carefully dressed pillar of stone, meaning It was cut to be this shape. But you can't cut these textures. So what could be cylindrical and this rough texture? It's a fossil tree trunk. Look, you can see where the bark has split, revealing the wood grain underneath. All around, you can see traces of that. Now, don't switch off when I say what I'm going to say next. Some of these cut marks can only have been made when it was wood, not when it was stone. Look here, the bark has dragged. Stone would have split or shattered. And down here, two distinct marks, blows, where the wood has pulped. And you can't make these marks in stone unless it's something like a mudstone, but in that case, you won't get these textures. Now, you'll either think I'm crazy, or you'll be as stunned as I was yesterday, because as far as I was concerned, the latest fossil wood comes from the Miocene period, which is about 20 million years ago. I sat on the floor, stunned and confused, and then rang a friend of mine who knows about these things, and apparently the latest research from Japan has proved that petrification, so that's turning into stone, can occur much faster than we thought, and it is conceivable that a piece of wood this size could petrify in under a century. But that's in extreme conditions. Now, even if we give it a few thousand years, we still have a wonderful story. We could have a tree trunk that has been worked by man. It falls into a bog with a high acid content and a high silica content, and over that period of time, it turns to stone. Now, when it was found again, it must have seemed like a thing of absolute magic. To Neolithic man, wood symbolized life and stone symbolized death. So here was a being of life and afterlife, living and dead. Whether it was found by the builders of Bryn Celli Ddu or whether it was brought here from elsewhere, already a highly prized item, we may never know. I'm just amazed that nobody has written about this before, and I hope that specialists get here to date it, and soon, because if it is 20 million years old, I don't know what I'll do.
Fascinating. Wouldn't it throw some of our existing dating systems out of the window if he's right? 20 million years?
Yes. I'd love to see some follow-up investigations at Bryn Celli Ddu. Anyway, I think you'll agree he's a fascinating man to listen to.
Most definitely, and the scenery is incredibly beautiful. It just makes you want to put on your wellies and get out there, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Now I think we've got some time for some more music.
Righto. In keeping with the ancestors, the historic landscape and tribes, let's have a listen to Tribal Gathering by Kelturia.
Thank you.
That was Tribal Gathering by Keltoria from their album Leofal, which, as you know, is the name of the Stone of Destiny, one of the four sacred objects that the Tuatha De Dananann brought with them to ancient Erin.
Yes, and we'd like to thank Keltoria for their amazing support for the show, and you'll find details about them and their music in our show notes. Should we have some listener feedback?
Okay, then.
We got an email from James from London, and he says...
Hi, guys.
Hi, James.
I just wanted to write to say thank you so much for the latest show. I downloaded it this morning as I was on my way to a meeting, so my commute was going to be longer than normal. Well, not only did my commute fly by, but the people on the bus must have thought me a bit odd, as I kept on laughing as I was listening to the incredible talk on the Women of the Grail. Dr. Rotherham was so entertaining and obviously passionate about his subject that it was a joy to hear and kept a smile on my face throughout the whole podcast.
I can understand that. Not only was he fascinating, but so entertaining.
Being half Welsh, obviously I'm looking forward to hearing the start of the Welsh myths which are coming up.
Yes, we are too. It's a whole new area to learn about. We're really excited.
I don't know if you considered this, but on the Say Something in Welsh site, which you plugged on the last special, they have set up a Google map where you can put a pin to say where you live. I'm not sure of all the ins and outs of this, but I for one would love to know how many other listeners on the show are based in London as I am, and as well as around the world.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. Do you think the guys will go for it?
I'll set one up and we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm stuck on another bus now, but I'm going to listen to Dr. Rowland again. Thank you both for all the hard work you do.
You're most welcome, James.
Blessings to you both and your family.
Thank you, and many blessings to you and yours, James.
Yes, I echo that. Blessings to you all, and thank you so much for your lovely email.
Let's have some promos from other interesting podcasts, shall we?
Sure. You go first.
Oh, okay then. Well, I've been chatting to an interesting chap, Tim, on Twitter, who does a show on Blog Talk Radio called Pagan Perspectives. Have a listen to his promo.
Hello, I'm Reverend Sylvanus Treewalker, host of Pagan Perspectives on Blog Talk Radio. Pagan Perspectives is a show for pagans of all traditions, witches, druids, shamans, and Azatru, with information, inspiration, music, and meditation, and of course, a wee bit of magic. And now, even our listeners can bring their talent to the show on our Bardic Circle segment. So if you want to learn and share with a show that has a unique perspective, then tune in to Pagan Perspectives, Sundays at 2 p.m. Central Standard Time. That's Pagan Perspectives at blogtalkradio.com.
Ooh, sounds like he covers a lot of ground. I'm going to have to give him a listen.
Oh yes, it's really worthwhile listening to his show. Now, what promo did you find?
Well, there's a beautiful area of forest in the south of England called the New Forest. I'm sure a lot of our friends over the water who are considering holidays this way will be considering the New Forest as a possible holiday destination. So, here is an easy-to-listen-to podcast all about life in and around the New Forest. Have a listen to the New Forest podcast.
Join me, Alex Fenson, at www.newforestpodcast.co.uk, bringing you news, views, facts, figures, coming events from around the New Forest here in the south of UK, mixed with a selection of Podsafe music. Join me now at www.newforestpodcast.co.uk.
Oh, Alex sounds like he has an interesting show there, doesn't he?
He does. Now, who's going to tell everyone about our special surprise?
Well, that'll be me then. I want to. Please.
Oh, all right. Off you go.
Do you remember we were telling you that our friend Dave the Bard has a new album coming out?
Yes.
Well, he's finished it.
Yes. Great stuff. So, can we get it now?
Well, it's called Tales from the Crowman and is available to pre-order from his website, paganmusic.co.uk. From Samhain.
And I think it's actually going to be out on December the 3rd, something like that. In time
That's right,
Christmas.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, but he's accepting pre-orders from Samhain.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep, so go along there this weekend and pre-order your signed copy.
So we can't get it yet, but it's nearly here.
Yes, that's true. But we do have a world-exclusive preview track from it that we can listen to right now.
Oh, what is it?
It's Dave's version of the Twa Corbies, and I think you'll find it's different to any other version you've heard. In fact, it's perfect for this time of year, just a little bit gory.
Okay, don't keep me in suspense any longer. Just play it.
Oh, all right then.
Forevermore, the wind shall blow forevermore.
That was superb. Thank you so much, Dave. That was the Twar Corbies by Dave the Bard from his new album.
If you order Dave's fabulous folk album now, you'll get a signed copy to give all your loved ones for Christmas.
Oh, I see. Now I know what you want for Christmas.
Really? Or did I say anything? Did I even hint?
From his new album, Tales from the Crowman. You'll find more details in the show notes, including links to where Dave has all the lyrics to the new songs.
So with Dave to play us out, I think we've got to say goodbye to you all.
Yes. And until next time, we'd like to say...
Slongefoil. So who is the Kailoch? The Kailoch. Kailoch.
Kailoch.
Kailoch. So who... Exploring the myths, folklore and legends of the preeminent
Celtic cag goddess, perhaps.
That's it. Don't start me giggling, because I'll never shut up. We'll be here all night.
It'll be Samhain 2010 by the time we finish.
One to the other did say, oh, where shall we go and dine today?
Taken from the legendary use of the Walpole. Andy Walpole? Maybe that's where he's
Andy Walpole.
Out behind that old high dye.
Exploring the myths unknown.
No one knows that he lies there, oh, but his hawk and his hound and his lady fair.
Winter was heralded, as implied by the symbolism of the white sow covering the land.
White sow covering the land? That's one big pig. I mean, I really wouldn't want to have anything to do with that pig.
You know, I think Ceridwen's jealous. Do you know why? Do you know, Ceridwen is known as the white sow, which is quite interesting. I think she thinks we should be talking about her instead.
I see.
Anyway, I'll do that again. You do you know, I didn't even hear myself say that.
Well, you made a right pig's ear. Right? And I'm not telling porkies.
All right, okay, that's enough. Exploring the myths, folklore and legends of the preeminent Celtic hag goddess.
Hey!
Finally!
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com.
We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us an email or some voice feedback to Gary and Ruth at CelticMythPodShow.com. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. You can find them at www.sfhounds.com. We'd also like to say a big thank you to Anne Roos, Master Harper, and Keltoria, with a K, Celtic New Age Music, who have both given the show unrestricted access to their music. And thanks again go to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used as some of the transitions you've heard in this show. You'll find links to all of these wonderful artists in the show notes at shownotes.celticmythpodshow.com.